Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Once again, it's time for our weekly Q&A with Layla, which is one of our most fun segments where we answer virtually any question that you send our way via radio program at AOL.com. So you never know what you're going to hear. You'll hear a question about a condition that is relevant to you. Radio program at AOL.com gets you an opportunity to have us field your questions. By us, I mean yours truly and Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mudin. She's a registered dietitian. She's also earned a master's degree in the field of nutrition. So welcome, Layla. How are you doing?
All right, Dr. Hoffman. How are you?
Very well, thank you. So, all right, before we get to questions, what's in the news? Anything in particular on your end?
Well, Ted Cruz dissing gluten sensitivity and celiac?
Oh, yeah. Okay, that story.
What is that about? That's, oh, no.
That story is making the rounds because, all right, so here's, you know, regardless what you think of the various political candidates, they're prone to gaffes, you know, as they move through this slogging, relentless take-no-prisoners political campaign. So Ted Cruz, in an effort to demonstrate his tough bona fides, weighed in against America's PC culture by claiming that the military now issues gluten-free MREs to soldiers. And he said that this is the height of absurdity. How can we be, you know, so effete and so wussified as to do this this kind of PC stuff when it comes to the military? The military needs to be tough and combative and, you know, should not be concerning itself with these, you know, cultural fads like gluten-free. That was his contention.
Cultural fad.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So look, I mean, he stepped in it because, frankly,
He stepped in it.
He stepped in it, absolutely. He slept in a gluten-free mud pie because, you know, virtually 10% of the population has gluten sensitivity. That may translate to as many as 15 million voters or potential voters. And so he's just the entire gluten-free community. Besides, he's inaccurate on this military thing because I did a little research on this. And it turns out that there are no gluten-free MREs. I don't know where he got that. But, you know, I guess a bunch of 12-year-olds are doing research for these candidates. Some of the things that come out of their mouths are just unbelievable when it comes to a fact check. In fact, and this is kind of crazy, the military makes no accommodation for individuals with celiac disease or gluten problems. You can actually claim a military exemption if you have gluten intolerance, which is pretty cool because back in the day, I was contemplating fleeing to Canada to escape the draft. You know, I was a revolutionary young person in those days, and you know, it was the Vietnam War, and we were anti-war in those days, So now all you have to
conscious
do is say,
objector. Yeah,
right. You don't have to shoot yourself in the foot or, you know, amputate your toe. You can just claim you're gluten sensitive and the military won't accept you. Of course, there's no draft these days. So we're, you know, very different times.
Right.
But, you know, actually there's an interesting book and I'll see if I can get the reference to it. I did talk about it on one of my radio programs, which is a book by a guy in the army who was stationed in Kandahar. You know, it's like one of the worst places in the world you can be stationed in because it's like a remote outpost that's constantly being attacked by the Taliban. And he recounts his experience of trying to lead a gluten-free existence, you know, with meals literally dropped in by helicopter. And he had a heck of a time because he lost about 40 pounds initially because he was so... he was
nothing
so deprived of food because everything had gluten in it. Finally, he got some gluten-free flour drop shipped to him via some helpful friends or relatives stateside, and they finally got it to him. And he took gluten-free flour, and he enlisted the help of a local Afghan pizza parlor I guess just imagine how this transpires. It's like great international cooperation, you know. And they managed to make gluten-free, whatever, pizza and products for him so that he could survive his assignment, his stationing there in Kandahar. So literally, Ted Cruz, wrong to diss the gluten-free community because this is a for real thing. You know, he thinks it's all made up. It's like all the stuff of effete Hollywood actors and actresses and, you know, the affluent ultra-liberals who shop at Whole Foods, you know, these environmental nuts, he would characterize them as. And at the same time, he even got his facts wrong about the military policy, because the military is blissfully or not so blissfully ignorant of the requirements of individuals who need accommodation for gluten intolerance.
Yeah.
So anyway, so there you have it. I mean, hey, you may like other aspects of his political platform, but, you know, as far as I'm concerned, it's a bit of a disqualifier.
That's something to also be taken up by military dietitians.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, you would think. And here's the other thing. I mean, the food is the food that GIs get is very crucial. And the problem is that it's all about you know, cost containment and, you know, their budgetary constraints. But if military recruits got even some omega-3 fatty acids in their diet, I bet there would be a lot less in the way of depression, suicide, you know, these outbreaks of sometimes homicidal behavior by returning GIs who have post-traumatic stress disorder. Omega-3 fatty acids may play an important role in alleviating mental problems. And so I really think they need to explore that strategy. Plus, certain nutrients could help to prevent one of the biggest problems the military has, which is hearing loss, you know, with the sounds of grenades and gunfire, but also just the sound of loud military equipment. You know, just a helicopter or a transport plane or a tank generates very high decibel sound. There's a lot of money expended at the VA hospitals for disability, hearing disability. And if the military is actually interested in this, and they're doing some research on how to forestall that with the proper nutritional support, things like alpha-lipoic acid, N-acetylcysteine, even cheaper magnesium, these have been shown to forestall hearing loss. So anyway, so interesting.
Earplugs.
Yeah, good old-fashioned earplugs.
Earplugs.
Yeah, earplugs. But sometimes, you know, they're not feasible, or, you know, they don't get used, or whatever sound bypasses the earplugs, you know. Earplugs is a cheap way to do it. All right. So that being said, hey, you know, we want to remain neutral in this political campaign. But so far, you know, well, here's an interesting facet to this campaign. There's very few things that I agree with Bernie Sanders on in terms of his political platform, full disclosure. But the one thing is he is the foremost champion among the political candidates for GMO labeling. Which is a risky position for him to take, because that really precludes a lot of corporate donations from Monsanto and agribusiness. And he's calling it as it is. You know, he's come from a state, Vermont, where it's the only, one of the most progressive states in the country, where they actually have voted in a GMO labeling law. And now the Senate has passed through the committee, I guess it's on Agriculture and Commerce, the bill that is the DARC Act, which actually will prohibit labeling of GMOs, has passed through committee and may be voted on in the Senate. It's just an unbelievable state of affairs. So, you know, here we have our government working against the interest of the public and trying to keep the public in the dark about GMOs. It's just an insane situation.
They're working for the special interests. That's what's anyway.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, that to some extent, that's a theme of this political campaign, is we don't want business as usual. Although, you know, sometimes candidates wave that banner, and once they're in office, things have a way of staying the same, just because of the way that the political process is structured.
Yeah, yeah. The checks and balances ensures that,
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we've got a question from Judy. Judy writes, a couple of weeks ago, Dr. Hoffman, you were talking to Dr. Lynn Patrick discussing remedies for liver disease. I noticed you didn't mention milk thistle and was wondering if it was overlooked. And would you recommend taking it on an empty stomach?
Okay, good question. And, you know, as I was doing that interview with Lynn Packer, by the way, an excellent interview about liver disease and natural approaches to liver disease, very common problem in this country. A lot of people have fatty liver.
Yeah.
Some of them will develop cirrhosis of the liver. Some may necessitate liver transplantation. So there's a lot of that going on. And Lynn Patrick is, Dr. Lynn Patrick, a naturopathic physician, very authoritative on that subject. She's done a tremendous amount of research. And I regret that, given our limited time, we could not talk about everything under the sun that was helpful for liver problems. And clearly, milk thistle deserves a place among the supplements that are helpful for liver disorders. One consideration about milk thistle, and you probably know this, Layla, and maybe you can elaborate, is that it may change the metabolism of certain drugs. So the people on certain medications that they need chronically may have to either adjust their medications or maybe forgo milk thistle because of its properties. Do you have something to weigh in on that?
Right.
I believe
the,
what it does
is the P450,
right.
The P450 pathway.
Yeah.
That actually influences that.
Right.
I don't know if the list is rather long, but anybody taking milk thistle needs to have a review.
Mm-hmm.
Of their medications.
Okay. And this is here's part of the problem is that, you know, you go to a health food store and you may say, look, I'm on all these drugs and I want to detoxify my liver because I think that these drugs are making me toxic. So the guy or the gal behind the counter says, well, great. Milk thistle is really good at doing that. It'll detoxify your liver. Well, it will detoxify your liver. And one of the ways it does that is it may reduce the effective levels of certain medications.
Mm-hmm.
So it may render them less toxic, maybe enable them to be metabolized more rapidly, but that in turn may lower their therapeutic effect. So that's why you got to be a little careful with milk thistle. Not that milk thistle is not to be used, especially, you know, when you're not on a lot of the implicated medications.
Right.
Okay.
Judy, thank you very much for that thoughtful question.
Sure.
All right. Harry writes, Dear Dr. Hoffman and Layla, I received the book How Not to Die by Michael Greger, MD, as a present.
Why didn't I think of that title from one of my books? Why didn't I not think of that? That's the ultimate title.
Oh, it is so terrible. I would back away from that title immediately if I saw that in a bookstore. Anyway,
but
Harry
it kind of lays it out, right? I mean, it's like, that's the basic question,
Let's see. Look both ways when crossing the street.
Right.
Anyway, Harry writes, please reassure me that eating quality meat, eggs, and fish is still the way to go. He preaches a strict plant-based diet only.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we do know this about Dr. Michael Greger, and that is his agenda.
I don't know him. What is his, what are his bona fides? Is he a PhD nutritionist or a medical doctor, or what is
He's a medical doctor.
He is? Okay. Mm-hmm.
He's an MD.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's an MD.
Is he part of that PCRM group, the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine?
I don't know.
Because I never heard of him.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's a little dumbed down to say that that's the way you can avert death. I mean, I think we can go into in detail arguments pro and con for inclusion, prudent inclusion of healthy animal protein. For some people, that's an oxymoron in the diet because, you know, now there are many studies that debunk the connection between animal protein consumption and cancer and heart disease and on and on. And so, you know, There's something to be said for a vegan diet. However, the vegan diet does not escape the pitfalls of sometimes excess starch and carbohydrates. There's difficulties with compliance. There's some people who have a deficiency of nutrients, feel weak and tired, don't do that well on it. But I want to honor and respect the people who follow a vegan diet out of principle or desire to extend their longevity, because at the very least they're consuming lots and lots of plant foods. I have no argument with that. That is absolutely my credo. I think we all need to consume an enormous amount of plant foods. You know, ironically, Layla, I'm on the paleo diet right now. I've been extending my whole 30. I've re-upped, and I'm in my third month.
Uh-huh.
And I have to say that some people may think, well, this guy's just eating an inordinate amount of meat. He's just stuffing himself with, prime rib and steak and, you know, hamburgers. Mm-hmm. And actually, I'm finding that I've never before eaten as many vegetables because in the absence of convenience foods like chips and gluten-free bagels and muffins and breads, you got to eat a lot of vegetables and you got to eat some fruit. And I'm just enjoying the flavors of many vegetables I haven't visited in a long time. I just made turnips the other night. I have made some wonderful soup out of cabbage and potatoes with a natural broth that I made from the remains of chickens I've been eating. And, you know, lots of avocados, big, huge salads with a variety of ingredients. And, you know, so it goes.
And that's a staple on a paleo diet.
And lots of potatoes and lots of sweet potatoes and butternut squash and Hokkaido squash and all these unusual squashes that I'm baking.
I guess when people think paleo diet, paleolithic diet, I guess they have the visual of a caveman with a spear or taking down the woolly mammoth or something like that.
Yeah. I took
Not necessarily gathering plants or anything.
I took down that stereotype in a recent article that you can find at drhoffman.com. It went out with our newsletter last week, which is called Paleo Pitfalls. And you know, one of the considerations there is when you follow paleo, what paleo are you following? If your idea of a paleo diet is just you know a lot of meat and steak and you know hot dogs and hamburgers, that's not really paleo.
There were no hot dogs,
right? But that, but also, you know, pretty clearly, for the most part, with the exception of a few cultures, you know, perhaps the Eskimos in Arctic regions or you know tribes in the during the Ice Age. There was a lot of vegetables in the diet of hunter-gatherers, and they only scored big. Sometimes they'd be lucky enough to bag a mammoth or a giant bison, you know, because they were predecessors to our modern bison that were really huge. You know, these deer that were many times larger than current deer. But these animals were virtually hunted into extinction by 10,000 years ago. And the so the vast majority of people on the so-called paleo diet may have consumed lots and lots of vegetables, roots, berries, you know, lots of stuff.
Nuts and seeds.
Nuts and seeds, yeah. So so we tend to stereotype it.
Yeah. Again, I would still back away from that book, How Not to Die. It's just terrible. It's so negative. Okay.
And well. You know what? She used a good verb there because she said what this author preaches, and it's, you know, he's not even talking about reasonable advocacy. He's talking about a creed or an ideology that he's that he's preaching from the pulpit of the book, which is a platform for getting the word out about what he already believes in, which is vegetarianism. And that's not science, that's ideology. You can, and you know, you can't argue ideology, you can't argue science, but once it gets in the realm of ideology, it's like arguing politics or arguing religion, you know, which is the better religion, which is the better political system. It's, there's an element of ideology, although it's often presented as fact.
Right, right. Harry, thank you for that great question. All right. From Harry, now we go to Larry.
Harry, Larry, and Mo. Right.
Dear Dr. Hoffman and Layla, the current Harvard Medical School newsletter claims that people with diabetes need to restrict their egg consumption. I'm baffled by this. I would love to hear your take on this.
What's the headline? How Not to Die?
right.
But that's from Harvard, so the Harvard is
they're very
smart at Harvard. You know, that's since it's the Harvard newsletter, it's the smartest newsletter because I mean I merely went to Columbia, so they're not as smart as the people at Harvard. And so if you can append the name of an institution to your newsletter, you can really enhance the value of the newsletter. I think that the Harvard newsletter probably has as much to do with Harvard as you and I have to do with ISIS. You know, it basically, it's a name, a trademark that got borrowed or bought. Probably very few of the people who write the articles there are on Harvard faculty. However, there's a kernel of truth to that article, and it has to do with a study that shows that diabetics actually fare slightly worse when they consume a lot of eggs. So help us interpret that, because how could it be that non-diabetics seem to do fine with eggs, but diabetics don't? I mean, there's no sugar in eggs, so what's up with that?
No, and you have to consider, when you're having eggs, say for breakfast, what about everything that accompanies it? The home fries, the toast,
right?
The juice,
yep.
The sugar in the coffee,
yep.
You know, all of that. So how are they able to narrow it down to the egg?
Yeah, so
as opposed to everything else that's in the diet.
This is an example of correlation, not causation, because certain things are a marker maybe for less healthy eating styles. So people who choose to avoid eggs, they're very fastidious about their diets. They may be more careful about including vegetables, about overall caloric reduction. People who indiscriminately eat eggs, they may be less attuned to other public health warnings. And so we have a situation where people consume a lot of eggs. As you say, may also be the very selfsame people who order the OJ, who order the Danish, who, you know, pour on the calories, have you know, big piles of hash browns, overeat, are obese, and hence are more prone to problems when they're diabetic. But it's interesting that selfsame studies don't even show that effect in non-diabetics. It's just diabetics may be much more prone to cardiovascular problems. So I think if they isolated it to, like, look at me, for example, and look at you, for example, I consumed a three-egg omelet this morning before doing this podcast with you. However, I didn't have any accompaniment to that. I had no juice. I actually had some pieces of a paleo wrap made with turmeric and coconut. And that's, you know, very low glycemic index, relatively
very
low
nice.
Calorie. And so the predominance of my meal was protein, and very satisfying, very satiating. So, you know, perhaps if they looked at consumers like me who eat a lot of eggs, but in the context of a relatively low carbohydrate diet and a clean diet that includes a lot of fresh fruits and vegetables, they might have found a different outcome.
Absolutely, they would find a different outcome.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
So now, this concludes part one, because we generally divide our podcast into two parts. So give us a preview of what we'll find in part two.
Okay. How do we know our supplements are bioavailable? Shouldn't we be tested before and after the taking supplements?
Very good. Good question. We'll take it up in part two of today's Q&A with Layla. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.